I was thinking what to say about the speaker, and a story comes to mind. Some of the alumni took a cruise earlier this year, early this year in January, and our speaker, we're walking along a path in Kalika at the Tulum Ruins, specifically says not to get off the path. But there he saw a big old iguana that he just had to take a picture of, okay? And we're all telling him, don't get off the path. That iguana's gonna bite you. But let me tell you, until he got that picture, he wasn't happy. And I have a copy of that picture, and it turned out to be a good picture. You know, our speaker is somebody that, like most of us, has had a lot of challenges, and you know, what I find about him is that he doesn't use those challenges as an excuse, and you know, it's somebody that I see work the program, and I would like to go ahead and introduce to you our speaker, Kirk.
My name's Kirk R., and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Can y'all hear me all right? Now you see, I get privileges because I raid around here. No, I have cancer, so they figure that they're going to try and prop me up.
Hang on a second. Let's make sure where you're good. All right, now do it.
You ready?
I don't want you to fall.
This is like riding a horse for the first time. Did I get on the right side?
You're okay.
Okay. All right. All right. You know, cowboy. You know. The first time I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, it had been quite a while back. And of all things, I saw an ad on television, and it was showing family interactions of people. Isn't it nice to be loved? it was a bunch of people in a dysfunctional family. Gee, we wouldn't know anything about that now, would we? And they weren't getting along too well, and I was watching this family, and I could identify with it, you know. I was sitting in a chair where I had my leg propped up, where I'd accidentally shot myself in the leg with a nail gun, and I was drinking dark and tan beers, Guinness and Heart mixed, you know. And I wrote down that number, and I decided, well, I'm gonna call them and see what this thing is about. And so I went and got the phone and got back over there, and I dialed the phone number, you know. I never told anybody I was an alcoholic before. So I was kind of scared and a little kind of squeaky voice, you know. I said, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And the lady says, well, I'm sorry, I'm just a secretary here and we sell drywall. So, leave it to a drunk to remember a phone number, you know. So I thought, all hell. Well, that gave me a good excuse, right? So I proceeded to nest right there, and keep those dark and tans a-coming until the commercial was going to come back on, you know. And I don't know, maybe it was 8 or 10 hours later. I don't know. It was quite a while. And, I was pretty stewed anyway by the time it came on. And but it did. It came on. And I got the number, and I called this number, and lady answers the phone, and she says, "Hi, this is Happy. May I help you?" And I thought, oh, hell, I did it again, man. You know. But really, that was her name. And she had been in recovery for many years and was a very sweet lady. And she told me, she says, "If you'll come down here, I'll give you a big hug." And I don't know about you guys, but the hugs have been kind of sparse lately. you know, I was drinking a little bit more than anything else, and that kind of was operating, taking up most of my time, so I didn't have much time for hugs. So I said, "Well, what the hell, you know?" yeah, I was drunk and I went down there. But, you know, I got down there, and when I got there, they told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't exactly know what to think about it at first. But they said that, you know, there were people all over the world that were in this organization, and that this was the only known cure for alcoholism. And when we say cure, we mean contingent on your daily maintenance of your spiritual condition. It's not like, you know, you take a pill and you're cured. This is something we have to work at every day. And so I was interested in it and signed up for an outpatient addiction program. And I was in that thing for a while, and those people seemed to like me for some reason, I don't know, but back then in the early 80s, there wasn't a whole lot of groups, I guess, either that or they just were desperate for help, I don't know. They asked me if I wouldn't mind doing some aftercare work for them, and I had to do some things, and they represented me, and and therefore I became a certified addiction counselor without having to go through all the brouhaha that everybody has to go through nowadays. Now, that didn't last very long, but the thing that I thought was kind of fascinating about it was, it was the first time in my life that I had to argue with anybody about not getting paid. I wanted to get as little money as possible, and I had never done that before because I wanted to give back to them because I'd been sober for 2 years at that time, and then my life had already changed dramatically. That was a great experience right there. But being an alcoholic and working the 12 steps and being a human being, if you don't stay on top of these steps, or if I didn't stay on top of these steps, then they'd sneak up and bite me in the ass. And I guess the next one that bit me in the ass was lust, you know. Sex was just something I just, you know, had a hard time with. And it was one of those deals that coming honest with sex was kind of tough, because, you know, I was interested in chasing all the skirts and tails that I could at that time. You know, I mean, hey, you know, I mean, I'm in my 20s, you know. Early 70s. So, so there my character defects came out and bit me one time. And through the period of my sobriety, I would come up with things that I believed to be good reasons why I would go back out, but they were just excuses. My best friend died while he was skiing behind the boat, and had an embolism, and you know, so I used that as an excuse to go out and drink. And then the girl that I was engaged to was murdered down in Daytona, and the guy cut her up all and never got to say goodbye to her, and so that was an excuse. My problem was I couldn't handle life on life's terms when it got down to the real nitty-gritty of it. I didn't do well with it. When the shit hit the fan, I went back to what I knew, and what I knew was drinking to kill the pain, because the pain was just too much for me. And I had other instances where, you know, other things happened, but I think that gives you an idea about something about that stuff. Now, there were times when I had drinking, and then it was a lot of fun, you know. But, you know, I think that's understood. I think y'all understand that, you know, there are some times where, you know, drinking is fun, and then it turns down to where the drink starts drinking me. At one point in time, I think I was drinking the drink, and then the drink started drinking me. And, boy, this is a great chair. It's two-piece. It's kind of like my recliner that I just got rid of. It's got a little rot to it, too. So if I bust my ass, y'all get a good laugh. Little entertainment for you. Well, you know, there was some other things that happened to me. I had been sober for a while, and this program gave me the greatest life that I'd ever known. And I had been working the steps for some time, and I was on a job, and a building collapsed, and wasn't anything I built now. It was... Really, it wasn't, you know. It did crush me like a bug, and it was pretty nasty, you know. I had a lot of surgeries and a traumatic brain injury and stuff, and whoa! See what I mean? Traumatic brain injuries coming again.
Sit still, brother.
What do you mean sit still? You get that thing to sit still.
All right, try it again.
All right. We need some duct tape. You know?
Strap you in.
Ain't nobody strapping me in a chair. I'm not in any big hurry to be, you know, those straitjackets and shit are for the carnies. I'm not into that shit at all. But I discovered that life was hard and life wasn't fair. And there were things that were going to come up in life that without help, I couldn't deal with on my own. I had gotten a lot of good spirituality from the program, but, you know, the spiritual maintenance, daily maintenance, is the thing that really is so critical for me. And I thought if I could keep that up, you know, life would be better until the building fell on me. But when the building did fall on me and I had an out-of-body experience, I really did, which was a unique thing. I didn't see any white tunnel or anything, but I did see, I was floating around on the ceiling, and I did see people down there, you know, doing things. When I flatlined, they all moved away, and the guy took his hand off the oxygen mask, and I looked down, and I said, "Holy shit, that's me! I gotta get in there and fight," you know. But I believe that I would not have lived through that accident had I not had the strength and the spirituality that I gained from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the power that I gained from it gave me more strength than I ever thought I could have, which I guess kind of moves along to another thing. I had some incidences where after that I had nurses and things, attendant care and things like that. People were taking care of me, and you know, they don't pay them a lot of money, and they were pretty much addicts, and they were you know, robbing me blind. And not that, you know, I'm not trying to say there's a difference between alcoholics and addicts, but back in the early 80s, we used to say, you know, the difference between an alcoholic and an addict, and say, well, an alcoholic could give you the shirt off his back and an addict would steal it, you know. But that's kind of the way we used to say, but you know, that's a long time ago, so I don't know if that still is a bearing. But when I went through what I went through there, they rated me as a 12-year-old with a traumatic brain injury, and I was in pretty dire straits, and my family came to try and help me and see what they could do. And my ex-wife decided she'd do what she could do, and that was find another guy and tell me that, you know, she was pregnant with some other guy's kid. I'll leave out all the expletives that she left. But when that all was said and done, I ended up, you know, in Ridgeview, where I came here. And I had back in the early 80s met a gentleman, Father Noel, at a Rock Eagle. And I was up in Cottage C, and I was telling him, I said, boy, I remember this guy, his name was Father Noel, and he was talking at Rock Eagle, and man, that guy was great. He said, God cannot not love me. No matter what happens, God cannot not love me. Even if I stick a knife in my brother's back, God cannot not love me. And not that I planned on it, but that just, you know, that was pretty awesome, you know. That just sunk in to me. And you know, I was talking to them about it, and they said, "You mean the Father Noel that speaks here every Sunday?" And I said, "He speaks here every Sunday?" And they said, "Yeah." And I said, "Wow, you know, that's a God moment there, you know. That was one of those things that told me I knew I was in the right place. It was one of those ways of God telling me you're in the right place. This is where you need to be." And when I found out about that, other things started happening. And when I was coining out, Sam Anders was doing the coins, and he said he remembered when he got his first coin. When he coined out, some old guy gave it to him. And afterwards, I went over to him and I said, it was Joe Hubbard, wasn't it? And he reared back like that. He said, "How the hell did you know that?" I said, "I heard Joe Hubbard's voice when you said that." Now, this is no joke. And that was pretty amazing. That was another thing when I said, "Man, I know I'm in the right place." I don't know whether he does this to everybody or not, and maybe he doesn't, I don't know. But I kept having these it's not odd, it's God moments periodically through my treatment here at Ridgeview. And they were so enlightening and so profound that it took me way beyond believing. It took me way into knowing that this is true. I didn't have to question it anymore. And today, I don't question it anymore. Presently, I'm, you know, active on the steering committee and do things what I can do now. And I, like I mentioned earlier, I have cancer, and the doctors gave me my expiration date, you know, when I'm supposed to, you know, like milk, you know, when you're supposed to expire, you know. And I guess they're still stiffing the jug because I'm still walking around and I ain't dead yet. So I don't know when I'm going to die, you know. Recently, just at the doctor's office, a doctor told me, my cancer doctor, he said that my tumors, it has metastasized up through my chest and this, that, and the other, rah, 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 from my liver. And he said, it was so big, he says, "Well, you know, it's close to the size of a basketball now. It used to be a grapefruit, and now it's..." But, you know, there's something that tells me inside that I'm just not going anywhere. I feel too good. I've got too much to live for. I'll tell you what, every day I get up and I'm just tickled to death. I've got the greatest kids and greatest family and friends, and I see them, and you know, this is the best life I've ever had right now that I'm living, and I have cancer. Now, does that make any sense? Might not to y'all, but boy, it does to me, because I am happier than I've ever been, and I'm truly, truly filled with joy every morning. I get up and I sing and play with the dogs and wrestle and play with the kids and goof off and you know, just feel like a damn teenager again. And I couldn't have this if it wasn't for the program. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have it. These 12 steps in the program and the 12 traditions of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is without a doubt the most powerful, most freeing thing that I have ever experienced. And I think about, I could have got it when I was younger, and I could have got it, and I went back, you know, and I went back to try again. I tried every way I could to prove that I wasn't alcoholic. I really did, I you know. Because to me, alcoholic, I thought my dad was an alcoholic, and I wasn't real crazy about the way my dad acted. But, you know, my dad and I ended up being close before he passed away. And he quit drinking, and we were able to have peace, genuine peace between us before he passed away. And that was really such a blessing. I was able to actually help out some when he was passing, which was something I never could have done if I was drinking or using drugs. So today, being responsible, being accountable, doing the right things for no other reason than just because it helps me and it helps others. And why not? You know, why not? I can't imagine anymore why anybody would want to live the way I used to live. My God, that was a self-imposed hell, you know. I mean, it was absolutely miserable. And I am so grateful for the Ridgeview and the wonderful people here. They just love you until you can learn to love yourself. And the activities that we have here and everybody's sharing their intimacies, their problems, and opening up and being honest and open and willing to let us look at them and try and help them. And in turn, they try and help us. And it's just a beautiful thing. It's just a beautiful thing. So what I would say is, don't wait. Don't wait. Don't wait. Don't wait like I did, as long as I did. Grab a hold of it. Get with somebody that you can work it with. And There isn't anybody in this room that can't get it. Anybody in here can get this. It's not like you can't get it. It's not like you're defective and you can't get it. That's not it at all. You just got to be open, willing, you know, and rigorously honest. And you can get it too. And then you can trudge the road of happiness, happy destiny with us. God bless you all. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Kirk, for sharing your story with us.